Mothering Midlife Daughters brings up guilt, sorrow, love, joy, anguish, longing, forgiveness, reckoning. It never ends. Next on Through the Eyes of Women. Welcome to Through the Eyes of Women, a program featuring the lives and perspectives of women, local, national, and international. Sandra Butler is the author of Conspiracy of Silence, The Trauma of Incest, which came out in 1978. Conspiracy of Silence broke silence about issues of incest and sexual violation, and was the first time I read the word survivor instead of victim. Her second book, Cancer in Two Voices, co-authored with Barbara Rosenblum, was the winner of the 1991 Lambda Literary Award. Cancer in Two Voices speaks openly, candidly, and lovingly about how a lesbian couple navigates the death of a partner. Now in her late 70s with two adult daughters, Butler has completed her third book, It Never Ends, Mothering Middle-Aged Daughters, with Nan Fink Geffen. Over the past three decades, Sandra Butler has facilitated workshops for community activists, social workers, and psychologists on the intersecting political, economic, cultural, and psychological dimensions of violence against women, and has lectured on women's issues nationally and internationally. Sandra Butler, welcome to Through the Eyes of Women.
Hello.
I must say that through our past connections, we have a mutual friend, Marinelle Eva.
Yeah.
And I was at a special place, which was a therapeutic daycare center for children at risk, when we were discussing at that time in the early 80s the cycle of violence, writing scripts for child assault prevention. You wrote The Conspiracy of Silence right before that and talked about surviving the trauma of incest, survivors versus victims. Then our paths crossed again when I was talking about Cancer in Two Voices, where Victoria Rood did a master's thesis and Cancer Bodies was a play inspired by the book, later to become Ruffled Irises. I welcome you to the show, and I'm looking very much forward to talking about your new book. But first, I'd like to introduce you to our audience. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, thank you so much for reminding me of all that history. It gives me several things, really, that I want to say. One of them is the woman who I think, if my memory serves me, was the director of a special place was Marinelle Eva.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Marinelle Eva and Nan Geffen, my co-author, and I, and four other women, have been members of a consciousness-raising group that's coming up to its 30th year called the Wandering Menstrual. And we gathered around our early 50s to really try to have an environment in which we could talk about menopause, the politics of menopause, the psychology of menopause. We wanted to have a place to talk about all of that in that political, structural form with other women. And by the time we got to the end of our 60s, we were really having such a wonderful connection and wonderful conversations. We meet still the first Saturday of every month, that we decided to continue. And now we're coming up. I'm going to be 80 soon. We're coming up to the 30th year. And the conversations are probably the bedrock of most of my thinking and most of my thinking out loud and exploring and learning what other women think about the things that I'm living through. And that actually was the genesis of this book, with Nan and I being in the group together. And when the group began, our children were in their early 20s, and we experienced ourselves as still mothering. They were still at the stage in their lives where it was the first love affair or the first divorce or the first job or the first apartment, and we were still sort of actively trying to guide them through all of these steps into autonomous adulthood. But now our children are in their 50s, and it's really clear that our mothering doesn't look like that at all. It looks like something very different. And in the larger culture, there's not really any sense that we're still mothering, but of course we are. So that's, I guess, one place to tell you a little bit about me. Another place is to reference the books and the description that you had of me in the introduction, which is breaking silence has really been very much the through line of all the work that I've tried to do in the world, in my writing, in my political activism, and in my domestic life. And so Conspiracy of Silence was the first exploration of sexual violence from a feminist perspective. Cancer in Two Voices is still actually the only book about the loss of a partner written from the perspective of both partners. And it was another silence that I wanted to explore. And with this book now, there's been several very interesting dimensions to it. One of them is that Nan and I have been very close friends for 30 years. We both have middle-aged daughters. We're very, very different. We're mothering in very different kinds of ways, but we're still mothering. And when we talked about it, and to try to figure out what it means to say we're still mothering, we started to look around for books, because that's what we do. And as is often the case, the novels, the poets, they're way ahead. And there were some really marvelous novels and books of poetry, but the social sciences were very inadequate to what we wanted to know. There's a lot of self-help stuff, how to improve your relationship. In other words, how to make your mothering better without even defining what it is that the mothering is. And then there's a lot of interviews, which were very interesting, but they were interviews of the mothers and the daughters together. And we felt suspicious that mothers are going to speak freely in front of their daughters in a way that we would learn what we were both trying to learn. So we decided to limit it to daughters because sons, the expectation of intimacy, the continuity of the family, the similarity in bodies, all that kind of stuff suggested that a mother-son book would be a very different and important, but a very different project. So we decided to do what feminists have done since at least my experience of second wave feminism, anyhow, which is if you want to know what the lives of women are, you need to sit with them and ask them. And they will be able to tell you. And they need to be the subjects of their own lives, not the objects of study. So we decided to work together, and the collaboration part of the work was every bit as demanding as the interview part of the work, because I had never worked collaboratively before in a creative project, only in political ones. And the fact that we were such close friends, are such close friends, that was a dimension of what it means to be a friend and how to create a cultural product within the crucible of that kind of intimacy. But before I even say anything about that, we started talking to women from about 65 to 83 was pretty much the age range. And much as we had suspected, the very first thing that they asked was, this is going to be anonymous, right? And it was clear that they had a lot to say, but they didn't want their daughters to hear it until they were ready to say it directly to them. But women in all three of my books, when assured of a safe and respectful environment, are eager, grateful, appreciative to talk about the nature of their own lives. So not only did we interview 78 women, but women who heard about the book through the grapevine would stop us with their own stories and their own observations. So it's not social science rigor. It's more kind of snowball talking to women. It's very, very much a beginning of a conversation that has not been had, where the directors of the conversation are old women, much as with Conspiracy of Silence, the directors of the conversation had to be the survivors, not the experts. So we see this as something that's opening a conversation, something that needs thousands of voices to add on to what we've already begun to understand. And it's very exciting.
In fact, you encourage women who do read the book to get back to you and Nan with our own experiences.
Exactly. We want more voices. One of the things that's been interesting when Nan and I go to speak, people want to know how many women feel this or that, or how many women decide this or that. And we're very clear that we are neither experts nor able to say anything conclusive. This is a beginning, just as the other two books were beginning. We want to add voices. Now, the 78 women we did interview, as much as we could, we have a pretty good cross-section of race and class and geography and sexuality and education. So we have at least the beginnings of some of that information, but certainly it's nothing conclusive. It's just really interesting.
I love hearing their voices. Pat, Dolores, Gloria, Margot, Cindy, and Florence are the characters in the book, and they're probably a composite of these 78 women.
Uh-huh.
And how you and Nan weave them into every topic that has probably come up in your 30 years of conversations between all of you. And I find that absolutely delightful. And I look forward to hearing what Margot said about this topic, or what, you know, how Elise would react to that. You talk about statistics. One thing, though, that I found very interesting is that you say that nearly half of the women interviewed said that they aren't very close to their daughters. And that pretty much seems to go across the lines. How did you work with those feelings?
Thank you for this question, because it's really the through line of every single thing that emerged in the interviews. When we began the interview, it was with a very neutral, general question, which was, tell us a little bit about your relationship with your daughter. And consistently, women used the word close in describing it. They were very close, not as close as they wanted, getting closer. That seemed to be some kind of core descriptor that women were using. And some of it had to do with the comparative dimension of mothers and daughters, which is an important thing, I think, to allow to emerge as this conversation goes forward. Women compare their relationships with their daughters to their friends' relationship with their daughters. So if they're pretty much like their friends, they feel the closeness is good. If it's less, they feel somehow wanting, and if it's more, they feel proud. None of this is realistic, but that comparative thing is a shadow that we wanted to make sure that we brought forward. But when we went a little bit more deeply into the conversation, what we began to understand is the very word closeness is defined so differently by individual mothers. So, for example, for some women, regularity is what's really the definition of closeness. You know that on Sunday morning you'll talk on the phone, or you'll Skype, or you'll have coffee together, or whatever it is, and no matter what else happens, you count on that. It's being able to know that that's part of your relationship. For other women, it's more about frequency. Even if it's just a short visit, 5 minutes on the run or something, gives mothers an ongoing sense of their daughter's lives and their sense of involvement with her. For other women, and I certainly would put myself in this category, it's words. Closeness comes from talking deeply about our lives, about our feelings. That's where the connection is. And for a lot of women that I interviewed, renting a video and curling up on the sofa with a bowl of popcorn, watching a movie together without saying a word, is a very deep sense of closeness. For some women, it's cooking, family holiday meals, you know, special recipes, or going shopping, browsing around the mall. So it's an enormously broad word that covers so many things. And only, as I say, as the interview deepened, were we able to get a sense of how closeness is experienced and expressed in the relationship.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Through the Eyes of Women here on KHSU. I'm your host, Brenda Starr, and my guest is Sandra Butler, who, along with Nan Fink Geffen, wrote It Never Ends, Mothering Middle-Aged Daughters, a new book from She Writes Press. Now, there is a sense of connectedness that I got reading this book, although I have no daughters, I have a son, and my mom died 26 years ago. But there's still that sense of connectedness, and maybe it comes from listening to other women talking about their relationships with their daughters, the descriptions and how they highlight that in each chapter. I was wondering also, we talked about the quality of the connection and the disappointment in their daughters. What other similarities did you find amongst the mothers?
Well, Let me just rephrase your question a little bit and say similarities and differences, because that was another very startling awareness that Nan and I came to. Some mothers really feel closer and more connected and more successful when their daughters are more like them, and some mothers feel more successful in their mothering if the daughters are less like them. And again, it's a very variable and subtle thing. This is one of the many reasons why Nan and I didn't feel we could come to any conclusions. So just to add on some even further complexity, then daughters have temperaments. So if you have an extrovert mother and an introvert daughter, or the other way around, if daughters have values that are similar to the mother or different than the mother, how does that affect the sense of closeness? So it's just so clear we're on the edge of such a gathering, such a rich body of information of what it is to be mothering, and then always with the understanding that we are mothering at a time of our lives when all the women we interviewed are retired. Many have community commitments, but they're retired from paid work outside the home. And they have more time and more inclination to want to be with their daughters. And their daughters are in their 50s, late 40s, 50s, in the middle of extremely busy lives with partners, work, children, all kinds of commitments. And the mother, even when the mother, the relationship with the mother is a wonderful, close one, is just one of the many pieces they have to fit together to make their time work. So the asymmetry, the structural asymmetry of time, is one of the realities of being a mother, winding her life down, being in an intimate relationship with her daughter who's in the middle of an extremely busy life.
Well, as you say, it's a work in progress. And
yes, indeed.
It also includes navigating the difficulties. Angry daughters, mothers' anger at daughters, when daughters reject mothers. And you do not shy away from talking about that and writing about that.
Uh-huh.
I was very moved. One mother had said, her heart is continually broken, but she has learned that one can go forward with a broken heart. Mothers do it all the time.
Yeah.
I've run across a lot of women who either are estranged from their mothers.
Yes.
And then consequently estranged from their daughters. There's that push and pull. And I don't think we had a character that kind of amplified that a lot. It seemed like a lot of women talked about that a lot.
Yes, we do. And, you know, part of the way we mothered was what our experience was as a daughter, and how, without realizing it, we gave our daughters what it was that we wanted as daughters, whether it was what the daughter wanted or not. So there's a very interesting cycle that Nan and I noticed, which was, and again, this is very generationally specific. I really want to be clear about that. I'm not speaking about younger mothers. I do think the world is changing in many, many ways for them. But for us, we came of age and consciousness in the 60s and the 70s. Everything was upended. And what intimacy meant, what closeness meant, was completely altered. Our mothers, the mothers of the 40s, 1940s, and 1950s, they mothered. There was no expectation I would be intimate with my mother. I would know who my mother was or what she felt or what her dreams were. That was not part of what mothering was in most of our childhoods. But after the 60s and the 70s, it became a desire and an expectation that there would be more psychological language. You would say to your kid, how do you feel? I can't remember my mother ever saying, how do I feel? I can remember her saying how I should behave. So we gave our daughters adventure, spontaneity, intimacy, all kinds of things that broke the limitations we felt as daughters. And in fact, what our daughters wanted was consistency, predictability. One daughter said, I want Tuesday to be like Wednesday. So what we see now as the cycle continues and our daughters are mothering is this helicopter mothering where the daughters are just on top of those kids all the time in a way that we were very, very determined not to be. So that part of the cultural unfolding is kind of an interesting through line that we found. But the other piece of your question, I think, is about the difficulties and the envy and the anger and the triangles that happened and the Mercury third life of divorce and how it reverberates for generations. One of the things I think that's important to say is there's something about being old, or at least being an old woman, or at least being the old women we know and spoke to, that really makes us so much braver. Because the things that mattered to us in our 50s, will they like me? Will they invite me back? Will they hire me? Am I being successful? Am I doing a good job? Those things are not even questions anymore. We have the capacity to look clearly, unsentimentally, realistically at what our lives have been, what it was we did well, what it was we didn't do well. And that courage allows us to reengage some of those wounded places with our daughters and open conversations, write letters, make apologies, or if the estrangement is complete, then accept that that's what it was. But that all is embedded in the courage that we really found in almost all of our interviews.
Talk about a time of reckoning where you talk about mothers becoming aware of the fragility of their lives and no longer have unlimited years ahead to sort through those tangled connections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the ability to acknowledge and accept the mistakes that we made, bringing lovers into the house, experimenting, moving from one coast to another. One woman talked about how her daughter said she fell asleep on piles of coats in strange bedrooms while her mother was at political meetings in the next room. You know, that kind of understanding that while you are trying to model a woman who is both domestically committed and involved in the larger world caused unwitting, unwanted wounds in your daughter, and to be able to say, you deserved more than you got. I was unsuccessful in what I did. In a genuine way of being able to enter the daughter's experience and acknowledge that what you were trying to do did not work and make whatever apologies are necessary because, you know, there's no lifelong relationship where we don't cause wounds to one another, where apologies are not necessary. It's just part of the complexity of relating. But with mothers and daughters, I think the mothers have said to us that they feel like they're not only in a relationship with their daughters, time is what matters, and using the time that they have, not that these mothers were getting ready to die, but that the heightened understanding of the years passing, that they need to use the time wisely, clearly, lovingly, giving the people that they love, and in this case their daughters, the very best of who they are. And I guess one very particular way to talk about that is that when a mother who's 75 is opening a conversation with a daughter who's 51, and she needs to acknowledge pieces of the past that were scarring or wounding or alienating for the daughter, one of the things that has happened in the 51 years of the daughter's life is that she has her own bruises, she's caused her own wounds, and, you know, nobody at 51 has the life they thought they were going to have at 25. Nobody does. And so the daughter has her bruises at 51, the mother has her bruises at 75, and in an interesting way, those bruises, which reflect the complexity of being a human being and the difficulty in loving in a skillful and sophisticated way, those bruises, that acknowledgement of this being a human being is really hard. Loving is really hard. That can be the opening place because the daughter now has her own lived experience of how intentions go awry and how assumptions can be misplaced in the same way that the mother did. And those conversations, at least with the reports that we've been given, have been very, very tear-filled, tender, and successful.
Now, at the end of the book, you and Ann have discussion questions, and I imagine mothers reading this book with others and sharing their relationship stories and responses with each other, as you have done with the menstrual minis.
The menstrual minis, right.
I was going to ask you the final question, which is, how has mothering your daughter changed who you have become? But I want to read something that you wrote that was posted in Psychology Today. You say, "I no longer call my daughter, but instead wait to hear from her. That way, I'm certain that she has both the inclination and time to visit. That way, I protect myself against the fear of hearing even the slight hesitation as she adjusts and juggles whatever it was she was planning to do at the moment the phone rang. I don't trust my spontaneous impulse just to hear her voice, but instead send a text or email with a brief update or asking when she has time to talk. It's a messy, complicated, never-ending business being a mother. I'm often caught between wanting more of my daughter's time and not wanting to be seen as demanding or needy by the child I love and miss. And now, for the first time, I wonder about the ways my mother must have missed me. And I see in that the past continues to exist in the present."
There's just so much to say about this. That's one dimension of my relationship with one daughter where her time is constellated in a particular way, as was mine at that stage of my life with my mother. I think that illuminates what the structural shift in terms of time and the care that needs to be taken. A fuller answer, though, would be that I have one daughter who is kind of a freewheeling person. She's an artist. She's spontaneous. She's playful. She's very open. She was that way when she was little, and she's still that way. My other daughter is precise and careful, watchful. She makes her way forward in a very purposeful kind of way. So consequently, these are two very, very different women, and I relate to them with much more wisdom now and much more acceptance of who they are and what's possible in each of our relationships, because when I'm with them, the time we spend, the things we talk about are completely different. And I think that I have the capacity now to see who they are, to love exactly as they are, and to adapt to being in the reality of who they are when I'm with them. And I think that that probably makes me a better friend, that I can accept and acknowledge who it is that's in front of me and adjust and adapt with an acceptance to who they are and make that relationship distinct and unique as each relationship is.
And so it goes.
And so it goes.
Sandra Butler, I want to thank you so much for being here on Through the Eyes of Women. I believe every woman who reads this book, who is a mother or wants to become a mother, would benefit from the stories, from the descriptions that are told. And from your very heartfelt for me when I read that was the connectedness that us daughters have with, gee, did we talk to mom enough? Did we do this? Did we do that? And it is quite a reflection whether you have a daughter or you don't.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Through the Eyes of Women. I've been your host, Brenda Starr, and I've been speaking with Sandra Butler about her new book, It Never Ends, Mothering Middle-Aged Daughters. For more information, go to sandrabutler.net. Through the Eyes of Women is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University. Thanks to today's engineer and editor, Katie Whiteside, and to the entire Through the Eyes of Women team. To listen to this program again, you can visit our blog at khsuwomen.com, where you can also learn more about the show and post listener comments. Join us again next Monday at 1:30, right here on KHSU.